The growth of income inequality and the creation of a growing class of super rich has received widespread media coverage. So, too, have the philanthropic efforts of some of the wealthiest members of society, the creation and activities of the Gates Foundation, and Warren Buffett's commitment to give 99% of his wealth away during his lifetime. Those are two prominent examples.
But can we really expect those who have benefited from current social structures, structures that have driven inequality, to be in the best position to remedy the problems that their actions have in part created? Or will their very positions in society inevitably cause them to seek to find solutions that would not threaten their comfortable position as winners?
Joining us on the phone is Anand Giridharadas, author of a fascinating new book titled Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to start by sort of setting a context. The book centers on the efforts of wealthy and powerful individuals who are trying to help remedy serious social problems. As you ask in the book, how can there be anything wrong with trying to do good?
Well, I think we live in an age of extraordinary generosity. You're right. And I think by any indication, this is a very generous time. You have billions and billions of dollars being given away by some of the folks you mentioned. You have 184 signatories to the Giving Pledge. You have elite graduates of American universities all seemingly wanting to change the world and make a difference and make an impact. You have it's hard to go to the store or the mall without buying products that change the world, a tote bag that changes the world, an iPhone case that will make the world a better place. All around us is this ideal, and many of us, frankly, work for corporations that do similar things, that have CSR initiatives and try to help people in their way. And yet, we have to square that fact with the fact that we also live in a time that has been extraordinarily punishing for regular Americans, for working and middle-class people in this country, that has actually increased inequality, that has actually managed to rig the economy in such a way that when progress rains on America, only the very few harvest the rainwater. And so what I set out to investigate in Winners Take All was, when you have such generosity, but you also have a system that is punishing the many at the expense of the few, what is the relationship really between the few and the many? And what is the relationship between the generosity and the predation? And what I found was, first of all, the generosity is simply not enough to make up for the predation. But I actually found something more disturbing and complicated as I reported the book, which is that generosity is part of how we actually maintain the system of predation, because it takes just enough of the edge off to keep the system going.
And one of the, if we look back at sort of the history of social change, and you look at the, some of the major programs in this country in the 1960s, those were driven by governmental action. And one of the observations I think that comes out of the book is that the move away from governmental action to deal with social change to this private action sort of puts a point on what you're saying, which is there is not the same tendency to look toward broad benefits, but rather at some level to maintain the status quo.
That's right. I think one of the things you see that I tried to capture in the book was that when the winners of our age have an interest in solving social problems, because of who they are, because of their power and their wealth, it's impossible for them almost to take an interest in causes without having an effect on those causes. It's impossible for them to, at least the way they presently operate, to step into the work of social justice without becoming leaders of the pursuit of social justice. So they've become powerful in these spaces. They have assumed the leadership of organizations. They get seats on board. Even more subtle ways, they reshape the language and discourse around these issues so that we talk more and more in ways that they kind of sponsor, because they fund institutes and they write books about social change. And as elites have taken control of social change, as their language and their funding and their leadership has has come to the fore in that arena. Social change has changed. They have changed what we understand by change. And they've redefined change in a direction where it's something that doesn't threaten power as much as it might. They've redefined change to be winner-friendly. And let me give your viewers and your listeners an example, which is on every issue, one thing that actually Americans on both sides of the aisle tend to agree is that we're at a moment in American life where we need transformational reform. Now, we disagree on what that is. But there's a widespread sense that fundamental things about the American dream and how it works need to be fixed. Well, if you take any major issue and ask what would the right kind of fix be on that issue that would actually solve the problem at the root and for everybody, a lot of those kinds of fixes are expensive for the winners. So what the winners do is they turn around and they offer a kinder, gentler, for them, form of change that would be less expensive. So on the issue of empowering women, it's very obvious that instead of just talking about empowering women, we should actually probably have some of the social policies that in other countries have actually allowed women to play the multiple roles that they play. The family policies, paternity leave, make it easier to do childcare, make it easier to have, make it easier to, you know, claim healthcare benefits. And the problem with those things, of course, is that they're expensive for the winners. They probably have to pay a little higher taxes for a society to provide that decency to women, the same decency that most other rich countries provide. Well, what do? The winners turn around and they say, well, you know, that's one way to empower women, but what about Lean In? What about mentorship circles? What about, you know, conferences where women could sit in circles and strengthen each other? That sounds like change. It sort of sounds uplifting and positive. But you know the advantage of that latter approach? It doesn't cost the winners anything. It puts the burden on women to solve the problem that women are the victims of, which is sexism. And that's the kind of thing that happens on issue after issue in our time. Instead of just rejecting the desires out there to make America better, the elite co-opt a version of change that smells like change, but isn't change. It's fake change. And they use it to try to blunt the appeal of real change.
This sounds so cynical and manipulative. Do you really think this is the intent of these winners, or do you think they really believe what they're saying and they're unconsciously not really moving the needle?
I think what is malevolent is how the system functions. But your question contains a very important truth, which is what I found is that when you look at the level of the individuals upholding these systems, I actually found that it is often very, very decent people who are upholding this indecent system and who are, through their actions and through their blind spots and through their rationalization, participating in creating something that I think if they are shown it clearly, perhaps they would be uncomfortable with having caused. And it's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I think a lot of rich people don't quite see what they have helped to bring about. And I also, of course, wrote this book generally for the rest of us to stop outsourcing change making to billionaires. But one of the things I found among those decent elite upholding an indecent system is that you do, frankly, have a spectrum from naive to shrewd. You certainly do have some folks who I think are very, very straightforward about their greed. I think about people on Wall Street that I have run into who are pretty straightforward. They're trying to make as much money as possible, who understand that what they do in certain industries is inherently predatory on, you know, middle class wages or things like that, but who, frankly, that's the life they want to live, and they use giving and some of these gestures simply to lubricate the engines of continued taking. That's the shrewd end of the spectrum. But I think there is a naive end of the spectrum, and a lot of people are on it, which is sort of more what I find in Silicon Valley, my reporting, which is people who genuinely think they're making things better, genuinely think that elites like them have the opportunity, a historic opportunity, to build things that will empower humanity. And in that hubris are actually totally blind to the ways in which they are creating monopolies, blind to the ways in which they're creating an economy that only works for the few, blind to the ways in which they've invented a new working class precariousness. And in some ways, the naive and the shrewd present different problems to us. The people who are just shrewd and greedy require one set of solutions around, you know, taxes and things like that. The people who are idealistic and genuinely trying to make the world a better place and can't brook the idea that what's good for them is not necessarily great for humanity, I think that requires a solution that we don't quite have within our grasp. Because you think about a company like Facebook allowing our election to be compromised. Part of what is so difficult about bringing them to account and changing is they believe deeply in the bones that Facebook and simply letting it grow and spread is the only thing that is going to, you know, improve humankind. The only kind of tool that can do that is they can. And that poses a real challenge for a democracy.
Before the before we started the interview, we were discussing sort of examples of different ways in which efforts are being perceived as sort of benefiting the masses, but in fact don't necessarily do so. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was, you know, where do you put the impact of a company like Uber, where on the one hand we're looking at lots and lots of people who are able to be entrepreneurs, if you will, but on the other hand we're really having a dramatic impact on the ability of sort of a historic group of taxi cab drivers who are able to make a reasonable living, terribly being threatened.
You know, what's interesting is Uber is such a fascinating example in so many ways. So let's trace it a little bit, because part of why Silicon Valley is so confounding is that its messianic sense of itself as making the world a better place and liberating man, it's rooted in a kernel of truth. Okay? And often, when any of us have delusions of grandeur and weird stories about ourselves, it's actually often because it has some anchoring in truth, which is what gives it oxygen. There's no question that it's an empowering thing that people have written some code on a phone, and by the way, made a phone and done all this other stuff, that allows anybody anywhere who's short on cash to, you know, like, become a driver immediately. And not have to go through the old certifications and not have to go show up at some central depot in certain cities. And,
or buy a medallion.
Correct. And, like, is that empowering? Yes. Can anyone deny that that's empowering? And certainly, I mean, New York is not one of them because there's a higher amount of regulation, but there are many parts of this country, there's, like, no regulation around it. That you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to get certified by the city. It's, like, up and running, right? I totally get that's empowering. I think what people don't understand about these companies is the way they operate, the way networks operate, the thing called network effects that tend to grow very quickly. And the bigger they grow, the more useful they become, and the fewer other companies are kind of able to enter the space. These companies gain a lot of power very quickly. And what happens is they gain a lot of power over workers. You, as a customer, would be very happy with Uber. But once Uber is kind of able to get the network and get a lot of traffic in your city, what it's able to do is then drive the prices further and further down, which is what it did when it came to New York and many other places. And what that does over time is it creates an economy in which workers have very little power. So yeah, they're empowered to download the app and plug and play and start working wherever they want. But things like unions, things like, you know, insurance policies that a taxi cab company may provide, any other, they go out the window. And Uber has said in court cases in California and elsewhere that it is not even a transportation company. It's not a taxi company. It's just a technology company that facilitates a booking between, you know, a free and empowered individual like you and a free and empowered driver. And it's just a matchmaker of, you know, making that connection happen. And gosh, if anything, if one of you kills each other, or if you go the wrong way, or you're late, or you know the car doesn't show, hey, we have nothing to do with this. And by the way, the driver can't really make a living, and if their wages kind of fall below minimum wage, sorry, you know, we're just like a phone book, basically. We're just basically like a, you know, we're just a matchmaker. And this is my problem with Silicon Valley. In the very moment that it has become the greatest engine of power in the world, I mean, what place on earth exerts more power over the world today? It has come into the habit of denying that very power because it just thinks of itself as, you know, these guys tinkering in a garage. It has refused to accept the reality of becoming the great power center of the world. And in that process, it has this kind of rebel, what I called in the book, the rebel king fantasy. You know, when you have in war-torn countries in many parts of this world, when you have, you know, a rebel army out there in the jungle and the mountains trying to fight a corrupt government. They're in their pickup trucks, and you got the leader in his beret driving around in the pickup truck, you know, shooting at the palace from far away. And then sometimes the rebel army wins. They win the war. The government leaves, the president, you know, flies off in a helicopter, and the rebel army, lo and behold, takes the palace. And I always say, when your rebel leader still is wearing his beret, even after he's become the new president, you're in trouble as a people. Why? Because he, think of Saddam Hussein, think of Mugabe, all these kind of guys, right? Why is it troubling when they still wear their beret? I'm being serious. It's troubling because they still think they're a rebel. They haven't accepted their arrival. They haven't accepted their power.
And the responsibility that
they are actually now power that needs to be watched over by others, mm-hmm. that they are fallible, that they could make mistakes, and that they need to, you know, frankly, have checks on them. Because they still think in their mind they're a dude in the back of a pickup truck shooting at the palace. They don't understand that they are the palace now. They can't exercise power responsibly. And when I see a Mark Zuckerberg or a little boy man like Elon Musk or others, what I see are kings who still think they are rebels in the back of the pickup truck and who refuse to accept their own responsibility.
We are talking to Anand Giridharadas, the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. This has been fascinating. I want to get back to something in the book, though. What is market world, as you describe it in the book, and how does it affect social change efforts?
Market world is, you know, one of the things I learned a long time ago as a writer, is that coinage is a very important way to make people kind of see reality in the way you're trying to help them see it. And so, you know, I decided I wanted to coin a word to scoop together a lot of disparate realities that I think are actually of a piece. And so market world is a term that I coined, one word, capital M, capital W, to capture a complex of people and institutions in our time who I think are absolutely trying to do good, but insist on their ability to do well at the same time. People who are trying to live on this win-win notion that is at the heart of my book, this idea that they can help others while making a killing, that they can save the world and also enrich themselves, that they can make a, you know, they can change the world without having their world change. And that complex of people and institutions include conferences and, you know, like the Aspen Institute and Davos and Clinton Global Initiative. It includes institutions like Goldman Sachs and McKinsey, which recruit young people in part by convincing them that by working there, you can learn how to change the world. It also encompasses, you know, those young people who are full of idealism. It encompasses CSR that's done by companies. That obviously encompasses the massive philanthropic world. In the U.S., $410 billion was given away philanthropically in last year or the year before. And it's this vast complex of people who want to have their cake and eat it too, want to be on the right side of justice, but don't want to give up their right to stand on top of a system that is fundamentally unfair.
And your concept of coinage, I think, is really important, because one of the you do that in a number of places in the book, and it really helps unify disparate facts and give it a context. Another piece of coinage that I really liked was in chapter 4, where you talk about the critic and the thought leader, which I take it is part of this complex that in order to sort of fit into market world, you need to toe a certain line.
Correct. And one of the things I, when I was writing the book, my editor said something that was very interesting. I don't know if it's a book that he had edited or just a book that he'd liked and read, but it was a book some years ago about cancer. And one of the things that writer had done was kind of to define cancer as a country. Cancer had its own language. It had its own territory. It had its own culture. And this writer had kind of given a new way to think of cancer by framing it that way. And that was kind of, the strange points of inspiration always when you're writing a book. And that, it seemed to me to try to understand Market World as a country. It has its territory. It's got its customs. It's got its kind of religion. And the thought leaders, where they fit in is, I think if you want to understand how can so many decent people uphold an indecent economy, you need the bridge of ideas, right? Because generally, decent people are going to fight for something decent. If a great mass of decent elites have been convinced collectively to push for something indecent, it's probably because they've all been convinced of certain things. So I was wondering, who is giving them their rationalization? Who is giving them the sense of intellectual permission to think that lean in is the same as universal daycare? Who is giving them the sense of intellectual permission to think that building one charter school in a poor neighborhood is the same as having equally and adequately public, adequately funded public schools for all? Who is convincing them that actually figuring out how to get health care for every American is kind of on the level with this kind of life extension technology that people are fantasizing about in Silicon Valley? And I realized that a certain kind of set of court thinkers, the way kings kept around court thinkers, these elites keep around a set of thinkers who they like, who don't threaten them, who don't talk about dethroning them, and who provide kind of intellectual validation for their approach to solving the world's problems. I call them those court thinkers, thought leaders. And this is a term that's, of course, out there. My kind of framework is you have real thinkers who are actually challenging power often, and then you have these kind of court thinkers who are often called thought leaders.
So it's broke. And sadly, our interview is almost over. We've got just a few minutes. What are your thoughts on where we go from here?
Let me spin that a different way. I think we have so bottomed out in this era of America that I actually think we have a very exciting chapter ahead of us. And let me sketch out what I think that is. About 100 years ago, we were in a very similar place to where we are now. We essentially had revolutions in technology and business that allowed the people who create things and private sector to outstrip the public's capacity to understand and regulate and order it. And that was the Industrial Revolution, of course. Now we have a new 100 years later. And the way that kind of mismatch ended was we had this amazing age of reform that followed, and we actually built, everything from the Food and Drug Administration to electrifying rural America to the interstate highway system. We had an era of public building and of infrastructure, physical and intangible, to kind of have our society keep up with what had changed in the world. And a lot of people's aches and pains went away once we actually built that shared infrastructure. I think we're basically ripe for another moment like that. We have this information revolution, globalization, automation, the rise of India and China, a lot of the rise of women and what that's done to men and the service economy and all demographic change. We have been through a lot, people, and we're discombobulated. And that's why Americans feel very discombobulated when you travel this country. But I don't think all is lost. And I don't think Donald Trump catering to a minority of Americans' resentment of other people is the only place that can go. I think when the Trump presidency ends, I hope it will mark the end of a longer era of fake change, of pseudo-reform, and will be the spark for a new age of genuine public-spirited reform. And what that means in practice for your listeners is the next time you see a problem, don't look for someone to blame for it and a politician pointing you to someone to blame. Look for solutions to that problem that are public, democratic, institutional, and universal, that will solve the problem at the root for everybody. I think a new age of reform over the next few decades looms in front of us, and I hope we can build it together.
We've been talking to Anand Giridharadas, the author of Winners Take All. I am so sorry because I have at least as many questions left to ask you as we've already asked, but we are out of time. I appreciate your time. Thank you for spending some time with us.
And thank you so much, and I'm happy to come back in the future.
And
we're in that age of reform.
We encourage our listeners to check out this book. It's quite well worth reading.